back to the Pathfinder 101 podcast.
Today's guest is Mr. Brendan Firk, electronic warfare officer in the U.S. Air Force. Thank you for your time, and let's jump right into the questions.
All right, sounds great.
Could you briefly explain your role as an electronic warfare officer in the U.S. Air Force?
Sure. So we'll start with generally what the Air Force means when they say electromagnetic warfare officer or electronic warfare officer. Turns out that it's actually a pretty broad job set. And I would say it's really anybody who operates equipment that interacts with or influences the electromagnetic spectrum. So think anything that broadcasts radio waves from cell phones to radios to radars. That's the purview of an electronic warfare officer. Then my specific brand of EWO, as you shorten it, is on the RC-135 reconnaissance electromagnetic support aircraft. And on board that aircraft, also known as the rivet joint, EWOs are primarily concerned with detection and identification of radar systems, specifically the threat systems to other Air Force or joint or coalition partner aircraft.
How did you prepare yourself to lead a career in the military? Like, what are some of the educational or other qualifications that are required? And what made you choose a career in the government over the corporate sector?
In college, that's really when I decided on this track. It took about a year or so to actually figure out that I wanted to apply to the Air Force. But at about my sophomore year of college, I actually hit kind of a breaking point in my studies where I said, I'm over being a student. I'm tired of this, you know, especially after the academic rigor of St. Mark's. I got to A&M and I was tired. There was plenty about my 4 years at A&M that were great and I loved it. But academically, I had reached a breaking point about 2 years in. And I said, you know what, I'm ready to do something. I want to do something real. And I was about that close to trying to enlist. I walked into the Army recruiter's office on campus because there is a significant ROTC, the reserve officer training portion of the accessions for the Air Force on campus at A&M, given its history as a military college. So I walk into this Army recruiter's office and say, hey, look, I am ready to do something. Can I at least be in the reserves while I finish my degree? And thankfully, this recruiter had the kindness and wisdom to say, pump the brakes. Just go ahead and finish your degree. If you're still interested in military service at the end of that, then commission as an officer. So we'll talk then. Initially, my interest in military service grew out of a larger desire to get into federal service in, you know, the alphabet soup of the intelligence community. So think CIA, NSA, et cetera. And of course, you know, somebody who grew up on too many James Bond and Jason Bourne movies, I tried to apply to a CIA summer internship, if you will, a junior fellowship, and got worse than a no. I got no response. So I said, okay, well, how am I going to build on that? How am I going to increase my chances? And at a federal hiring workshop that A&M put on, where they hosted agents from probably 15 or so federal agencies from ATF, Secret Service, CIA, DIA. And there was a common thread that was said, hey, military service is one of the best inroads into this world. Sweet. I can speak that language. So to speed up this portion of the story, it eventually ended up with me identifying that, hey, I'm going to try to go do intelligence for the Air Force. And that culminated with taking about a year or year and a half from my senior year to the time that I actually commissioned. And I think we're going to dig into a little bit later why I ended up being an EWO and not an intel officer. But the short of it was that I knew that in some form or fashion, I wanted to serve the American people, and how that ended up being was through the military.
I believe you pursued Spanish and political sciences at A&M. So what role do those play in your career today, and what other majors might be relevant to the work you do?
You are correct. Yep. I started off as a Spanish major in the College of Liberal Arts at Texas A&M, a good little department. You may know Texas A&M is not exactly known for its language programs. It's primarily an engineering school and an ag school, but had a lot of good experience with my Spanish education there, and realized as I got through so many of my major courses, thanks to all the credit that I carried over from, you know, St. Mark's and the AP classes, that by the end of my sophomore year, I pretty much had finished all of my core Spanish classes. And I figured, hey, I've got 4 years. I was fortunate enough to receive essentially a full ride 4-year scholarship. So I said, well, how am I going to spend these remaining 2 years? And I looked at possible minors and realized, hey, well, I've got credit hours to spend. Let's get a second major. And I had taken some intro political science stuff, and I'd always been kind of a politics and policy nerd just growing up. So it seemed like a logical fit. As far as being relevant to my career, not always. In fact, rarely, at least not on the label, right? So I'm not doing anything day to day with my Spanish language abilities. And, you know, I'm not a diplomat, and I'm not in academia. So my political science isn't always brought to bear. So what's really more applicable are kind of the intellectual curiosity and critical thinking skills that really started at St. Mark's, but then also, you know, you're instilled in through a 4-year degree program, which is why that's essentially what is required to be an officer in the military, is a 4-year degree. Doesn't really matter what. Some career paths, some jobs within the military will then further whittle down based on career qualifications. And the most common one is the STEM field. So I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, yeah, if you get a science, technology, engineering, mathematics, or medicine, like that's, medicine's different, but those will open different doors within the military that are not open to me because I don't have that qualification. But given that I work in a specific job specialty, in the Air Force, we call it an AFSC, Air Force Specialty Code, that says I'm an EWO. Given that I work in something that on its face looks like a STEM type field, dealing with radars and how they operate, and it's lots of numbers and it's physics, it's E&M, you learn on the job. I did always have a head for math and science, but there's a lot of on the job training. There's a lot of formal training that the military kind of programs. So really, you can get by with just about any degree. But like I said, never overestimate the power of STEM.
And on that topic, do you ever feel or like wish that you had taken some sort of STEM degree so that you could explore those paths? Or do you feel like the job you have today is like the right fit for you?
I had in the past. Right now, I'm very comfortable with the course that I ended up charting for myself academically. In college, I did go so far as attempting to get into the chemical engineering program as well as the petroleum engineering program, and said, hey, look, I carried all these credit hours. So even though you're telling me, hey, this is a 5-year degree program in 4 years, I said, yeah, but I've already knocked out a solid like year and a half of that. So can you work with me here? Can I still pursue my Spanish education and try to do engineering? And when they said, no, it's one or the other, I danced with the one who brought you. So I stuck with my Spanish. Again, similar instinct kind of cropped up this time a couple years into my military career. So by this time, I was stationed in the Omaha area in Nebraska at Offutt Air Force Base, and thinking, oh, well, I better go ahead and get back to school, get my master's degree done, not because it's required for my career development yet, but because I'm never going to have more time to do it than now. And I got to thinking, oh, well, I'd like to really dig into the technical side of what I do day to day when I'm really learning how radars operate and how that affects, you know, the aircraft that we look at ultimately defending or enabling, helping them do their jobs better. So I sought out a couple of physics departments at local universities and thought I was going to, I'm going to go figure out how to get my master's in physics. Thankfully, through a combination of, I'd say, good sense and perhaps a good dose of laziness, said, no, that's probably not a good idea. That's going to be biting off more than I can chew. Even though I had chosen to take some not required physics and calculus courses in college, just because I was passionate about math and science, I realized, okay, no, that's too much of a 90 degree turn in my academic growth. So I put that out of my mind. And then I also put my formal education on hold too. So no, to get down to the short answer, I don't really wish that I had done anything drastically different with my degree program. Perhaps the only thing that I would realistically change would be that when I picked up my political science degree, I had the choice of going the arts route or the science route, BA versus BS. And the key factor was a clump of language courses and a clump of math courses, respectively. And well, look at me with my hours and hours of Spanish credit. Well, that double counts. Why do I need to take probably another semester's worth of classes just because that would give me a BS? And that's about the only thing that approaches a regret in my time at A&M, is that I didn't take the time to take more math and just get that second degree, because in the end, it was another semester's worth of work. And I think that would have satisfied some of my curiosity, but I don't think it's had really any impact on my career. So I wouldn't call it a full-fledged regret.
Within each branch of the military, there are numerous subdivisions. And earlier you mentioned, like, why do you go into like EWO instead of Intel? So could you just jump into that?
Yeah. So a lot of it ends up being a numbers game. So to set the scene, I graduated from A&M in 2012, and it took about a year from my graduation date to when I commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Air Force. Along the way, I had to go through an application and accessions process. It took some time, and that included some standardized testing, the Air Force officer qualifying test. It took some medical examinations and evaluations. I started running. I'd always hated running. That's why I was a swimmer and played water polo at St. Mark's. I was just always more comfortable in the water, but I knew that running was going to be a part of my life. So I started running. So I started making some lifestyle changes. But the big thing that my recruiter helped me with, in addition to, you know, checking all the required boxes, was saying, here are the facts. If you want to be an Intel officer right now in the age of federal sequestration, the selection rates for non-flying officers, what they call non-rated officers, are about 6%. Now, if you were to wait a couple months and then apply to be on a rated board for flying crew positions, so pilots, fighter backseaters, EWOs, navigators, those all fall under the umbrella term of combat systems operator, and then also air battle managers and remote pilots, so your unmanned aerial vehicle pilots. So those are those four broad flying career fields. Hey, if you go that route, you'll get exposed to Intel every day. You will be involved in all the things that you want to know and learn and dig into. You're going to get it anyway. And you have about a 30% chance of getting to wear the uniform. So, okay, sweet. That was a no-brainer to 21-year-old Brendan at the time. So I said, yeah, sign me up. Let's do it. How did I end up being a CISO instead of a pilot? Looking back, I had the scores to be a pilot. I've got good eyes. I've got good spatial awareness. Truth be told, I was always good at standardized testing. So the AFOQT basically gave me a run of probably whatever I had wanted to apply for. But the flying jobs come with a price tag, because the Air Force and essentially the American taxpayer ponies up a big bill to train their air crew. We're going to spend all these years and all this money, you know, think jet fuel, maintaining aircraft, paying your room and board, you know, putting you up in all these facilities. We're going to get some return on our investment. So pilots, from the time they finish their undergraduate flight training and get their wings that they wear on their chest, they owe 10 years to the Air Force. CISOs owe 6.
Okay.
So at the time, I'm still thinking, I'm going to do my tour, and then I'm going to try to transition over to civilian federal service. So CIA, NSA, maybe State Department. That started creeping into my mind, but something that would involve hanging up the uniform. So I said, oh, yeah, I'll take, again, numbers game. 6 is shorter than 10. Let's do it. So I applied for that. I got selected and ultimately went to officer training school in February of 2013. Now, how did I actually decide to be an EWO? Because I told you, I've just fell under that umbrella term of CSO, CISO, that included EWOs. That didn't occur until I was actually in my undergraduate flying training at Pensacola. And as we got exposed to the different skill sets and the different missions that CISOs might do throughout the Air Force, whether it's sitting in the back of an F-15 Strike Eagle or sitting in a B-1 bomber dropping bombs or operating defensive equipment, or sitting in the back of an RC-135 looking at the electromagnetic spectrum and providing support to all those other aircraft and providing threat warning. So saying, hey, dude over there in the fighter, you're about to get shot by a surface-to-air missile, react accordingly. As we got exposed to all those missions, I realized my driving force was wanting to make sure that all of my buddies got to come home alive. So if I could, to be dramatic, if I could help somebody come home alive, that would, you know, I could sleep soundly at night. So I immediately fell in love with the mission of the RC-135 and the job that the EWO does. From there on out, it stopped being a numbers game and actually turned into passion.
And you mentioned earlier with the like, acceptance rates of like Intel was like 6% and mm-hmm. was like 30%. So mm-hmm. even if in your path, you get to experience like the Intel aspect as well, what are some key differentiating factors between the two?
Well, for one, I get to wear pajamas to work. So your Intel career field is a ground job with a few notable exceptions, but you live your career in ground facilities supporting operations. So broadly speaking, when aircraft take off and go do the things that they're going to do, we refer to that world as operations. And then there's other career fields that enable operations to be possible. So I can't go fly somewhere and do my job effectively if I don't really know what's going on. So I need intel. I can't take my aircraft there if I don't have people to put in it to fly. So that's where the personnel side comes in. I can't do my job effectively if I can't communicate. So, you know, we have all these areas of mission support that aren't necessarily the people in the aircraft. There's all these career fields within the Air Force of people that may never set foot onto a U.S. Air Force aircraft. There are opportunities for those folks to get familiarized and go take, they call them incentive flights, but go get to see how the other half lives, if you will. That's the biggest difference, is flying versus non-flying. But the day-to-day, you know, aside from like, hey, I get to wear that green baggy flight suit, is that I am concerned about going and executing, you know, that mission. It's about putting people in aircraft into potentially combat airspace and doing the things that they do best, versus if I'm in Intel, I'm probably more concerned about the data that's collected by intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance missions that, all right, hey, sweet, I've got pictures or recordings, and now I'm going to analyze that. I'm going to break it down. I'm going to understand the adversary, and I'm going to inform my operations crews, and I'm going to inform my decision makers. That's the big difference. So Intel has that. It is a support mission, but it also has its distinct mission. And I find myself influencing operations very differently being an EWO and being on the ops side of the world.
And you mentioned that now that you've developed sort of like more of a passion for the job because you're like ensuring the safety of your fellow Air Force members. Do you see yourself ever leaving the military and exploring more of that CIA, NSA, or State Department life?
So something you'll probably hear me say a lot today, if I haven't already said, is it depends. It's a very military answer, and it's not a dodge, but there are factors. So I'll have to back up a little bit. So in addition to my passion for, you know, the EO job, my responsibilities grew as my career progressed. So there's a lot of intentional development. So you don't just stay doing a job, you know, they intentionally try to take you on an upgrade path. So for the first couple of years while I was here at this base, I just did the basic EO job. So I went and I looked for radars and I said, hey, look what I found. Then I learned how to lead a crew. So they upgraded me, they gave me extra training. I got to really know my mission and my aircraft inside and out. And I learned how to work with other aircraft. And we talk about integration. So working as a whole combat force as opposed to just one jet. Then I had earned the confidence of my leadership. And they say, hey, we want you to teach other people to do that. So we want you to be an instructor. And I actually went from instructing kind of, you know, my day-to-day peers or some of the younger guys in my first squadron to the formal training unit where the new guys come in. So guys like me who had been in my shoes there 4 years prior, you know, fresh out of Pensacola, now I was training them how to be an EWO. I was still occasionally going and doing the job myself, but that's when I uncovered my passion for instruction. So to bring that back to your question about leaving the military, as I approach 10 years in the military, I'm also approaching a decision point. I have intended for many years now to see it through to retirement eligibility at 20 years. But at this point, I'm facing due to some medical events that we won't drill into today, my flying career is over. So I still get to do EWO things. I still train students in our simulator training on the ground. And I get to do some amazing, interesting, very thrilling things for the Air Force, but just on the ground. And that reality is going to change what doors are open for me, since I won't be able to be an EWO, at least not a flying EWO. So this is where the it depends comes in. As I look to whether I may find myself in a new job in the Air Force in the next year or so, if that fits my passions for understanding how we use the electromagnetic spectrum to ensure our national security and to ensure our superiority over our adversaries or enemies, if I can fulfill that passion and if I can fulfill my passion for instruction, then I'm happy to stay in the Air Force. If the Air Force, another term that you'll hear often when you talk to Air Force members is needs of the Air Force, and I'm doing air quotes here, realizing this is an audio medium. Needs of the Air Force means that while the Air Force does care about your hopes and dreams, the mission comes first. And that's part of the core values, right? So the Air Force core values are integrity first, service before self, and excellence in all we do. So when everybody who signs up to put on the uniform, you know, swears the oath they swear, there is that explicit understanding of sometimes my needs are going to take a backseat. But there's also the reality of, but there's a need to balance your needs versus the needs of the Air Force. So if the time comes where my needs are not compatible with what the Air Force needs for me, I'm realizing that I'm prepared to walk away from the Air Force. So we'll see what the next year brings and what the next 10 years bring, but I'm happy to stay in the Air Force, but I'm also prepared to leave. So it's going to be an interesting future.
Are there any sorts of continuing education or like testing that happens like regularly every couple of years or anything like that?
To an extent, yes. The best analogy to continuing education that I've experienced has been both the upgrade pathway that I referred to. So each of those upgrades in my flight career took the form of a block of time, a set period of anywhere from 2 to 6 months where I stopped doing my primary job of, you know, going and flying missions, and I focused on training and learning new skills. And then I would pair that also with an Air Force-wide concept called Professional Military Education, or PME. And so there are three tiers for officers to basically go back and get re-blued. So you get drink the blue Kool-Aid again. For captains, which is the top of the first tier in the officer rank structure, your third grade that you make, there's squadron officer school. So you go back after, hey, you've had 4 to 7 years to figure out what the Air Force is like. You should know how to do your job by now. You've probably become proficient and you're probably leading people. You should be leading people at this point, whether you're leading an office of 8 or you're leading, you know, a team of, in some cases, you know, 150. It really depends on your chosen career field. So whether you're leading maintenance professionals or you're like many flyers, you're kind of late to the leadership game because you spend so much time learning your technical skills of how to operate your mission aircraft. But that's that first step. So you have your primary developmental education. And then as time goes on, you get your field grade officers in that next tier. So now your majors start learning how to be staff officers, and they do intermediate education. And then there's a third school, the senior developmental education, where the Air Force finally grows those staff officers into senior leaders. So now I'm taking my lieutenant colonels who are about to become colonels, the very top end of the field grade officers. I'm preparing them to really run large chunks of the corporate Air Force structure. So, you know, we're talking about leading an entire operations group. So teams of squadrons full of hundreds of people. So the Air Force does have kind of an Air Force-wide system for deliberately developing and educating its members, both officer and enlisted. There's a parallel track for enlisted members as well. And then I'd say the third piece to continuing education in the Air Force is you're encouraged to go back to school, both through tuition assistance as well as the GI Bill. That's a bit of a mixed bag because, like I said, when I first tried to go back to grad school, the earlier in your career, when you don't need a master's degree, is when you're most likely to be able to get it done because you've got time. In my case, and we'll just kind of rough estimate, I was 26, 27, single, no kids, no house. I was renting. Very, relatively speaking, simple life, uncomplicated, great time to go back to school. But at this time, First Lieutenant Frerich, or about to be Captain Frerich, has no need of a master's degree. A master's degree is only required for officers to make the rank of colonel. You know, that's a whole 12 years away, at least at that point, if not more. And that's so not my problem right now, right? That's future Brendan's problem. Well, fast forward to now, 32-year-old Brendan, now Major Select Frerich. All right, I've got, you know, these education opportunities, like, hey, let's get this over with, because now I'm realizing, all right, I've got a house, I've got a daughter, another on the way, and school's a lot harder now, especially when you do it online and you realize that's a lot harder even than, you know, classes at St. Mark's, where and some of those classes are grueling. I look back on the academic rigor at St. Mark's and think, okay, yeah, I mean, that was hard and I was challenged, but you know, at least I could hash out this stuff in class in a conversation with people face to face. And then at the end of the day, like, all right, figuratively, the bell rings and I move on to the next thing. Well, asynchronous online learning relies on, hey, you got to meet word counts and you got twice a week deadlines and you're not making real connections with your classmates. So for a 3-hour credit course, you're putting in probably minimum of 10 hours a week. And that's more than I did in person at A&M. You know, my workload as a full-time undergrad student pulling, we'll just say like a 15 hour semester, or even some of my later semesters where I was only doing like 12 credit hours. I don't feel like I worked as hard as I had to just to do one online class. So you have to weigh the abilities of, hey, I have the flexibility to do this learning anywhere that I have a reliable internet connection with the, all right, I have to budget my time a lot more prudently because just the course requirements, the way they're set up for your professor to be able to evaluate your learning are, I'd say, a lot more structured and more demanding. So I'd say that's the third piece of continuing education in the Air Force that is, say, loosely required because not all officers in the Air Force become colonels. So it ends up being a moot point, but I would say many, many, many of my peers have already completed their master's degree for that reason. I'll finish this kind of section by adding that there are kind of one-off opportunities throughout the Air Force, whether through training programs like the weapons instructors course or some fellowships or intern opportunities where you can actually earn graduate level credit and even earn entire degrees. So some people manage to do it all at once, but those are not, I'd say, the mainstream. So those are kind of more unique opportunities. But I do know that education is very important to the Air Force and the Department of Defense at large. It's just a matter of what form it takes.
I had no idea that there were so many different, you know, moving parts. And even like, yeah, whenever I think of like one of the branches of the military, I didn't realize there were so many different roles that are available. And so thank you for sort of illuminating the darkness in that regard.
Yeah, no problem.
Could you briefly talk about a typical workday, work week, some daily responsibilities and work-life balance?
Sure. Yeah. And I will try to keep it brief this time in the interest of time. Yeah. So the day-to-day depends, right? If I'm home station here at Offutt, I typically have a normal, like call it 8 to 4 or what have you, but normal business hours, like 8-hour day, 5 days a week. That can vary with flight or sim operation. So, hey, my 8-hour day might start at 2 a.m. or it might start at 4 p.m. and end well into the middle of the night. But generally, you know, when we're home station, hey, it's 5 days a week. You get the weekends, you get holidays. It's great. It's pretty normal. You know, I'm home every night. But if we're doing exercises or if we're deployed or if I'm traveling for work, those hours can stretch or condense very quickly. I'll go back to my last like true deployment to Southwest Asia. We would basically routinely work 16-hour days. So the cycle would be, you know, you'd plan a mission, you'd get your 12-hour crew rest with an opportunity for 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, and then you'd go fly. And that flying day consisted of about 3 hours of making sure that everybody is ready to go, that we knew the plan, and then getting the aircraft ready to fly before we even took off. And then we'd go fly for 9, 10, 12 hours. We'd have to come back, shut down the aircraft, and clean up and go debrief. And so, I mean, yeah, we're talking 16 plus hour days, and we'd get about a day off, and then we'd rinse and repeat, do it again. So on that 3-day cycle. And it's not as rough as what some of our other military members go through, but you'll find that when you kind of surge your body like that, it gets old fast. You get worn out, and by about 3 months' time, you're wearing thin. That informed our leadership's kind of decision to cycle crews about every 90 days. More recently, an exercise out in Las Vegas at Nellis Air Force Base. So the Air Force is kind of preeminent large scale exercise where we bring a lot of aircraft from all over the country. So at Red Flag back in July, we were regularly working 12 to 14 hour days, and we were working on a night shift because that's when we could operate. That's when we had the airspace. That's when we could do what we needed to do. So, you know, there I am. I'm calling my wife and daughter as they're eating dinner or about to go to bed, and I'm starting my day. And then we go and practice doing the things and helping our crews learn. It can strain that again, like I said, the balance of the mission versus your personal needs, it can get strained, but sometimes that's also when it's the most fun. So you just have to monitor yourself. And the military is getting better too about understanding the needs of its members and realizing when people are at a breaking point. So we see real momentum and initiatives to help people take care of themselves and to care for others. So with, you know, violence prevention training, our chapel actually recently offered a private program called ASSIST, Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, something produced by a Canadian company, but with some real serious thought put behind it to help recognize when the folks around you might not be 100% and might be looking at hurting themselves or ending their lives, which, you know, we all know from the news, it's a huge problem within the veteran community as well as the active duty community. So there's a recognition that the strain that is put on the work-life balance, if you can even call it a balance, that strain is real. We have to manage and mitigate the risks that we take.
I believe earlier you were talking about some of your favorite aspects of your work and involved like ensuring the safety of your, you know, fellow Air Force members, also like the instructional part.
Yeah.
What are some other aspects that you find really either gratifying or just fun? And then what are some aspects that you dislike?
Yeah. I mean, I'll just hit instruction again. So, you know, getting to be in a room or getting to be in the sim, you know, on headset talking, you know, one-to-one with a student. And like when you have that moment where something clicks and they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Like, I feel you. And like, or, you know, just, or they open my eyes, you know, the gal in the chair in front of me might like do something different on her workstation. I'm like, wait, why'd you do that? She says, oh, well, you know, here, this would make it easier. I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. It would. Huh. Okay, cool. Yeah. So when I get to have moments like that, yeah, that makes my day. And then it's also really unique opportunities that, you know, I would not have had if I had not been in the Air Force and I had not been in the job that I'm in the Air Force. So a recent example was back in February. I spent 2 weeks in Colombia with four of my colleagues helping to teach the Colombian Air Force equivalent of our kind of our platform and an electronic attack platform, getting to teach them some tactics and helping them learn how to use their aircraft more effectively and how to support search and rescue using their aircraft. And not only was it just cool to be somewhere different, especially in one of the most bitter months of Nebraska winter, being down at near the equator was prime, but getting to dust off my Spanish language skills. You know, we were doing all this work in English. However, being able to meet the Colombian Air Force members where they are with their language, that really enhanced the experience. And so we had one native speaker on our team, and then we had me, and then the other three gringos were hopeless, right? So that was really gratifying. And, you know, those 2 weeks just really helped to fill my cup, if you will. Let's see, the other half, the negative half. Try not to be too negative. Honestly, man, the thing that mostly grinds a lot of us down on the day-to-day is infrastructure, IT. Especially in the world we live in, right? Everything really runs on, you know, networks, and it's emails, it's calendar invites, it's SharePoints. You know, I'm not maintaining a physical library of tactics documents. Somebody has a digital SharePoint on, pick a security domain, whether it's unclassified or all the way up to top secret, but it's all on networked IT, you know, cloud, pick a buzzword. And that is probably the biggest day-to-day frustration, is that a lot of it does not work as advertised. And sometimes it's hardware, sometimes it's network. It's endemic to the entire department, I'll say. You know, that's one where, not to be a policy wonk, but that's where when you look at like the things that really drive morale down is things that they're not properly resourced because, you know, the money's not there, or at least it's not spent right. So when we do spend a ton of money as a country on defense spending, and I know some people get tired of hearing the military ask for more, but that's one area where like, yeah, we need people, So we need people to keep joining. We need to keep the people that we have. So we need to not drive them out. And we need to give them the tools that they need, whether it's a working computer or a new aircraft. And again, I'm not making a policy pitch, but it's the things that day to day, like, man, when I can't log into my computer to check emails and find out if I have to fly tomorrow, right? That gets old. But I sound very doom and gloom, but really it pales into comparison to, you know, the good moments. So when I go spend the last 4 days down in Fort Walton or Destin, Florida, at a conference with a room full of decision makers on how the Air Force uses the electromagnetic spectrum, I mean, yeah, okay, I don't care about our network problems, because, man, we're doing some creative problem solving, and we're doing it in a room together. So sweet, let's get over it.
In terms of the soft skills versus the technical skills, oftentimes in certain professions, soft skills can be way more important than the technical skills. Mm-hmm. So what role does that play in your day-to-day job? And yeah, could you just speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, especially as an officer, or if anybody listening is interested in, you know, the enlisted route, you know, for the non-commissioned officers out there, you know, when you start leaving the season of your career where you're a technical expert and you start really focusing on the leadership side of your career, your responsibilities as a leader, you know, that's when those soft skills, if you haven't learned them by that point, it's going to be hard. You're going to be hurting. And those are the ones that arguably take longer to learn. Technical skills tend to be more perishable, right? So anybody who, especially in the engineering tech sectors, right? I mean, that's just moving rapid. So whatever you learned how to do in college, by the time you're done with your whatever 2-year on the job training to get on board with your company or your military branch, all that stuff's going to be relatively irrelevant. But what they're hiring you for, what they're signing you on for, is your ability to pick up the next thing. It's the, okay, how do I apply the lessons of the past? How do I use my critical thinking? And then how do I push the boundaries? They don't care that, you know, you knew how to program in Java. They care that you just demonstrated the ability to learn that language. And then, hey, you'll be able to master the next language, whatever it might be. Soft skills, those take, in my experience, longer to hone, and they're arguably more important the longer your career goes. But it starts with simple things, simple air quotes, things like being able to brief your mission plan. So when you're on an aircraft like ours, the rivet joint, you routinely have anywhere from like 20 to 30 operators on board who are all trying to cooperate to get the job done. So if you don't have the soft skills, if you don't have the communication skills to ensure that, you know, everybody is working like that well-oiled machine, you're going to have a bad day. And so we spend a surprising amount of time trying to hone those soft skills, even while it looks like we're spending all of our time building technical skills. I can recall, you know, doing my senior presentation, and I remember having to control my shaking. So I got done with kind of my demonstration. I played a portfolio of Beethoven piano music, and then I had, you know, some remarks to make. And I knew what I was going to talk about. I knew the stuff inside and out. I prepared. Alibi, I was sick. I still remember that. But, you know, I'm standing there in a suit and my leg is quivering and I'm trying to keep my voice from breaking, and I get through it and it's fine. So, you know, those public speaking skills, like, sure, everybody's afraid of public speaking. Doesn't come natural to all, but maybe, you know, I don't know, pick a number, but it's not many, right? That are just born speakers, but anybody can learn it. It's just a matter of, do you have to work harder on it? And I know I had to work harder on it. Even getting ready for this, it took me years to build up the confidence to respond to an email like yours, to say, hey, I'm going to engage with that. I'm going to recognize the effort put in on his side and meet them where they are. And I'm going to overcome, you know, my barriers that are, ooh, meeting new people is hard. Getting put on the spot is hard. That's uncomfortable. But the more you get into that uncomfortable zone, then I'm not going to say the easier it gets, or that it ever stops being uncomfortable, but you do get better at it. And the Air Force looks for that, because ultimately, when you talk about developing a leader who's going to be responsible for multi-million dollar aircraft and the hundreds of men and women who make operating that aircraft possible and make it possible to bring, you know, lethal and non-lethal effects to our enemies, I mean, that's a lot of responsibility. And ultimately, key is those people. Yeah, a leader can make sure that there's gas in the planes and air in the tires. But if you aren't engaging with the people you're leading, if you don't have the soft skills to care for those people, then, you know, the mission fails.
We're reaching with the last couple of questions. Without going into specifics, how does compensation look as maybe when you enter the military and then like as time goes on, just like in general?
Yeah, great question. So, man, we can get as specific as you want. I know other sectors of the labor market are very touchy about compensation. That's one beautiful thing about federal service, is that it's an open book. Now, I'm not going to tell you to go Google it right now, but anybody can hop on a computer and look up military base pay charts. So, you know, my salary is out there. And let me tell you, like, it's not bad to be an officer. I don't have it made in the shade by any means, but, you know, especially between my salary and my wife's salary, you know, we're able to now have a mortgage on the home that we need for our growing family. You know, we're both able to drive cars that aren't falling apart. We have great medical benefits because, you know, there's that prioritization by, you know, the legislation and the taxpayers who ultimately make it possible to say, hey, these are the people that go out and do this defense and security job. Medical care is pretty important, we think. So, you know, it's not perfect. It has its warts, but man, TRICARE has been such a benefit. But like I said, yeah, I'd encourage anybody who's curious about the compensation. I won't bore you with the numbers, but just go out there and Google it. Whether it's the housing allowance, BAH, or the base pay chart, so the core bucks, or aviation incentive pay, or what we call flight pay. So that just tiny little, not tiny, but relatively small compared to your base pay. Just a little extra seasoning every month. Say, hey, thanks for leveraging that skill, that technical skill of getting into an aircraft and working it, you know, anywhere from 100 feet off the ground to 60,000 off the ground. Like, so it's all out there, and it's anywhere from, unfortunately, at the lowest grades of the enlisted ranks, it's not great, to, you know, the longer you spend in the officer corps, it gets pretty great. I would try to sum it up. So I would say, there are a lot of people, you don't necessarily get into the military. You don't get into the military for the money. Okay, I will tell you that. But there are plenty of ways to be comfortable and meet your needs if you're committed. Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
What is your best advice for someone maybe at the end of their high school career, start of their college career, that's pretty interested in joining the military or some sort of support job like in that area? Mm-hmm. Is not really confirmed yet whether they want to, but they're like looking at the different options.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about dipping your toe in the water, starting that process, right? Because for anybody who even gets involved and they put in an application, they're going up for a board, they even get selected, you're not committed until, you know, you get on that bus to leave the processing station and go to basic, right? So there's always an out until like you're literally standing in the sun in, you know, in Alabama or San Antonio. But what advice would I give? I would say some of the greatest advice is that I got from my senior mentor in the Air Force is to think about what you want to do, not what you want to be. So the idea is don't pick a job title. You know, maybe I've reached somebody today and they say, man, being an EWO sounds great. I want to go be an EWO. Okay. I mean, yeah, that might work out for you. But think about what you want to do. So if you like playing a cool video game in the sky and also having really neat effects in the evolving space of military competition / conflict / war, okay, yeah, you probably want to consider this and maybe some other jobs that look like it. So worry less about the job title and more about what are you going to be doing at that job? And then just start asking people, look for people who are doing that thing you want to do, ask them how they got there, And then the final piece of advice is keep your nose clean. I hold a security clearance, more than the minimum security clearance that all military members get. And that comes with a price tag. There are higher security clearance levels that other people have to jump through more hoops for, right? And it's all a lot easier to gain and maintain that clearance if you don't have a criminal record, if you don't abuse prescription drugs, if you don't abuse alcohol. So all of that to say, keep your nose clean, because that will make your life easier. But, you know, live your life too. So one area that is like foreign travel, you're going to have to account for everywhere you've been outside of the country. That's fine. Don't stop traveling. You know, just be honest and open about who you are and who you've been up to that point. The one last kind of saying I'll leave you with from, you know, the military isms, there's a waiver for everything. So if you think that you've got some kind of disqualifying speck on your record somewhere, don't self-eliminate. Make them tell you no. And if they tell you, say, sure, you don't want to make an exception? Because chances are there's an exception out there.
That's a lot of great points, great advice. The last question I have is, do you have any final comments or thoughts to share before we end this podcast?
Oh, just one. And that is, if anybody in the Air Force is listening and knows that this was supposed to be a 45-minute discussion, they will eat me for lunch because I went way over time. So thank you for your patience, Swanick.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who's listening for choosing to spend your time with this podcast. I really appreciate it. Please be sure to check out Pathfinder101.com for more information like this. Thanks again, and have a great rest of your day.